Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In the first hour today, we will be talking about the first federal class action lawsuit that attempted to overhaul a foster care system. The case was known as the Wilder case, and it's set in New York City. It was first filed in the early 70s by a young lawyer named Marsha Lowry. It was a class action suit, and it challenged the operation of New York City's foster care system, essentially arguing that the system, which gave private, mostly religious agencies control of publicly financed foster care beds, argued that system was unconstitutional. The plaintiff in this case was a girl named Shirley Wilder. She was 13-year-old, abused runaway. She was African-American and Protestant, who, as a result of those two realities, had been bounced around and ultimately lost in the city's foster care system. We'll be talking about this long case, how it was finally resolved, the implications for foster care, and also talk a bit about what happened to Shirley Wilder. We'll be talking this morning about all of this with Nina Bernstein. She's a reporter for the New York Times and has been writing about this particular case, but also about foster care for a number of years. And she's authored a book that looks at this story, this tangled and complicated story. The title of her book is The Lost Children of Wilder, The Epic Struggle to Change Foster Care. Pantheon is the publisher. And it's in bookstores if you want to read it. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. And if you want to be part of the conversation, all you have to do is give us a call. We ask only that people who call just try to be brief and keep their comments short so that we can include as many different people as possible. But, of course, anybody's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Ms. Bernstein, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
I'm very glad to be on your show, David.
You I know, have been writing about the issue of foster care for many years now, and that you spent quite a lot of time working and researching the material for this book. How is it that this particular subject happened to engage you to this degree?
I think this was a topic that just seized me, found me from my first newspaper job in Iowa. Actually, I was summoned into the chambers of a judge, well, not summoned really, but invited in, and there was a teenager who was facing possible commitment to a state training school, and she it was not for any delinquency. It was essentially because her family didn't want her anymore, and it just seemed to me, I felt she was so powerless in the situation, and I was very interested in learning more about that system. I was only 21 at the time, and close enough to being a rebellious teenager that it really spoke to me. And then later, I covered children's court in Milwaukee for the Milwaukee, what was then the Milwaukee Journal. I've covered a lot of other issues, and been a foreign correspondent and for Newsday in Berlin and Bosnia, but I've always come back to this topic. And in this particular case, in the Wilder case, I really found that its facts haunted me.
Let's go to, and by way of background, maybe I'll ask this question. Talk a little bit about what the foster care system and the method of placement for children who needed foster care was like in New York in the early 70s, just before the case came to be.
Right. Well, really, the situation that Shirley faced explains it very well. Mm-hmm. Shirley was, as you said, a motherless, abused runaway from a home where her stepmother beat her, her alcoholic father sexually molested her, and she was taken into custody by the state for placement in this foster care system dominated by Catholic and Jewish charities. which by law were allowed to give preference to their own kind. And because she was non-Catholic, non-Jewish, non-white, she and other children like her essentially waited for the leftovers. That meant that she was rejected by one foster care agency after another. These were privately run, even though they were financed by taxpayers. And she spent the first, her 12th year in a detention center that had been already termed the year before by a commission, unfit for human habitation. And then, finally, a judge who was actually a real reformer, someone who had, Justine Wise Polier, who had spent her entire career trying to reform this sectarian system, was faced with no alternative but to send Shirley to a state training school, a reformatory, a very harsh place. So I think this was typical, in fact, of what happened to children who didn't fit the preferred categories. They ended up either being left by default in abusive situations, or they ended up being criminalized. She was sent as a quote-unquote person in need of supervision. And when she got to this reformatory, she was sexually assaulted by older girls, and she was quote-unquote treated by being confined in a dark cell, solitary confinement, when she fought back.
And so just to, again, to underscore this point, the kids who did not find placement through this system ended up going into essentially juvenile correctional institutions.
That's right. Or they were the other, I'll give you a couple of other consequences, hard to fathom today, but there was a paper bag test, what was known among city caseworkers as a paper bag test. If children were darker than a grocery bag, they, except in very extreme circumstances, did not take them into custody, even when the circumstances they were in were quite abusive, because they knew that the private foster care agencies, which controlled the beds, were highly unlikely to accept them. So they would be, the city would be left with them in emergency shelters, which became really dreadful and places and abusive places. And then a second example, the nuns of New York Foundling, this is well into the 60s, when they were in doubt about the racial heritage of a foundling, of a baby, they would have the baby carried, the nuns would carry the baby to the Museum of Natural History in New York, where a resident anthropologist would examine this child. And if it was determined that, yes, the child had African-American heritage, the likelihood, just the reality of the way placement was done, the likelihood was that that baby would spend the rest of his or her babyhood in an institutional nursery rather than being placed for adoption. So it had really far-reaching discriminatory impact. The fact that agencies could pick and were really expected to pick children of their own religion.
The lawsuit was filed by a young woman attorney who was working for the New York Civil Liberties Union, Marsha Lowry. Was this something that the civil liberties people in New York City had been thinking about for some time as being a problem, one that needed attention?
Well, I think there had been a recognition that there was a problem, but I think nobody saw it quite as sharply as Marsha Lowry did. And I think that there was also a kind of division within the civil liberties community in New York, because the Legal Aid Society, which did a lot of the day-to-day representation of children in court, tended to become part of the system to sort of accommodate. I think this is almost inevitable. And there was also the fact that their own board was heavy with people who were important in these religious charities. I think you had really the establishment, the power structure of New York, or the what sometimes it's called the permanent establishment, the permanent government, was really heavily represented on the boards of trustees of these religious charities. And they were part of the way New York City did business. And I think that was very hard to challenge. It took an outsider with the stubbornness and the, in some sense, lack of political concern that Marcia Lowry had to just move ahead, you know, kind of the bull in the china shop.
Let me again, at this point, maybe I should introduce again our guest for the first hour of the show today. We're talking with Nina Bernstein. She's a reporter for the New York Times, and we're talking about the story that she tells in her book, The Lost Children of Wilder. And the title of the book comes from the name of this lawsuit we're talking about here, the Wilder case, which was named after a young girl named Shirley Wilder. It was first filed in 1973. It took 25 years to be resolved, and ultimately really didn't help the person who was at the center of the case. It's sort of a long story and a long and very interesting one, and for people, you know, you might want to read more and look at the book. We'll try and do our best to at least sketch out the details of the story on the program today. Yes, go ahead.
One of the things about that I wanted to say about Shirley, when Shirley mm-hmm. did finally get accepted by one of the foster care agencies, she was 14, and she had just given birth to a son. This is what really drew me to the case, by the way, was that in going through court records, researching a story about troubles in the foster care system in 1990, I stumbled on this fact that Shirley had had a baby when she was 14 and had left him to the same foster care system that the lawsuit filed in her name had been trying to change. So, and I wanted to know what had happened to this baby. What happened to Shirley after giving birth was that everybody agreed that she needed birth control. You know, she was 14. She was already a mother. She had been sexually abused as a child. People knew she had no impulse control, and she had just been placed in an institution that was coeducational. But she was turned down for birth control. She was denied birth control by the agency because it was Catholic and it was against the principles of the agency. And I think it's something that we haven't really confronted in terms of what's current today. There's a lot of interest in, obviously, in the presidential level, but I think across the political spectrum, with having public money be spent by religious charities for social services. And I think we haven't quite confronted some of the contradictions like this one, that Shirley actually ran away from this facility after they confiscated the condoms that she secretly brought in. And she left her child, Lamont, behind to grow up in a series of foster homes, would-be adoptive placements, and institutions.
Maybe we should, or I should ask you to talk for a moment about what the essential argument was that Marcia Lowry was making in this lawsuit.
Marcia was making the argument that, first, the structure of foster care in New York was a violation of the First Amendment, of the separation of church and state, and that in practice it discriminated against children on the basis of race and religion, that it was that it violated both the First Amendment, separation of church and state, and the 14th Amendment, equal protection before the law. And actually, on the first point, the question of whether just on paper it violated the Constitution, she very quickly lost in 1974 what was then the process in New York. A three-judge panel ruled that this was not a mandatory religious placement. This was when practicable, when that it was essentially could be, if it was handled properly, it could be constitutional. And so what remained to be determined at trial, if necessary, was whether in practice it violated the Constitution. And that was the long road for Marcia in terms of the legal case, struggling to get this these issues to trial. She had depositions where all this information came out, like the nuns taking the babies to be examined by an anthropologist to determine their racial heritage, and many other sworn statements about the discrimination of the system, really beyond religion, to really dyed in the wool racial discrimination. But it was stuck in the courts. It was a hot potato politically, and it was bounced around year after year. And she decided that the case was really too good. That was the problem.
Hmm. And that this essentially is why it is that it took more than 20 years for this to be resolved?
Well, not only. It was ultimately, there was a settlement after 15 years. It took 15 years to get a settlement. It was the settlement, it was a very interesting, well, I should say the case, the filing of the case itself had some dramatic impacts. It was hugely controversial. And it, as lawsuits can sometimes be, it was a catalyst that opened up, in this system in particular, you have a real veil of confidentiality. This is a secret system in many respects. A court suit, depositions, courtroom testimony can really open it up to scrutiny by, among others, journalists. And that in itself can have an effect, and it did in this case. It certainly did change. Gave impetus to legislative changes that helped some. But what was very discouraging was that after a settlement that promised first come, first serve, children would be placed on the basis of their needs, not creed or convenience or race, certainly, that promised also an overhaul that would be good for all children, which was really what Marcia was after to begin with, was a system to overhaul the foster care system for all children. The enforcing this settlement proved terribly, terribly difficult. And one reason is because a court suit is a slow-moving thing, and the lives of children are, relatively speaking, childhood is pretty quick, and things change on the ground. And one of the things that changed was the crack epidemic, various recessions, and a huge increase in the number of kids coming into foster care.
The system that you've described, that the system for placement that was essentially controlled by religious agencies, primarily Catholic and Jewish, that had been that was in place in 1973 when the suit was filed, had been in place for some time. How is it that in New York City, the system for placing kids in foster care came to be like this?
The system of foster care in America generally and specifically in New York City, was very much shaped in the 19th century. In New York, it was shaped by immigration and the demographics of poverty in New York. The children who go into foster care are the children of the poor. We've tended to forget this in the last three generations or so, but in fact, a lot of the children of the poor in New York, of course, were Jewish kids and Catholic kids, the Irish Catholics, were we've forgotten, but they so dominated the jails, the mental institutions, the poorhouses in New York in the mid 19th century, that they were talked about as though they were some kind of inferior race. And one of the things that happened was that there were agencies that arose to rescue the next generation by sending them, for example, in orphan trains out west. And there were objections by their own parents and certainly some of the Catholic community who fought to establish their own institutions and to establish the political clout to get public funding to help keep kids in New York in either in Catholic homes or in institutions run by Catholics. It's really a quite understandable impulse, and what happened was that this really increased dramatically in an episode that I think of as a kind of precursor to our whole welfare reform impetus in this country, I mean, in this era. In 1875, a law was passed that children would no longer be allowed in the poorhouses where their parents took refuge, and instead public money would follow them into orphanages run by people of their own faith. The result was a huge boom in orphanages. And, of course, the same reformers who had established this in part to save children from the bad effects of poorhouses, and who had, I forgot to say, this was preceded by, or simultaneous with this, was a law that essentially ended relief to poor families in their own homes. They had done that to try to stop what they called pauperism. They were very worried about illegitimate births to immigrants, the size of these families that seemed to be not self-supporting. And so it was their effort to end dependency. But the same reformers then complained that parents were all too willing to turn their children over to these orphanages. So you have a huge increase in Catholic and also then followed by Jewish orphanages, and at the same time, more and more unhappiness about how children were turning out in these and how expensive it was, because substitute care always turns out to be more expensive than support for children in their own homes and the parents who are trying to raise them at home.
We're just about at the midpoint here, and we'll continue to talk with Nina Bernstein in just a moment. But first, we need to do this, as it is the first Tuesday of the month. We need to do this test of the emergency alert system. And this is WILL Urbana, Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and again, we're talking this morning with Nina Bernstein. She's a reporter for The New York Times and is the author of a book that lays out in some detail this case that we have been talking about, the Wilder case, and what it meant for foster care in New York. Her book is titled The Lost Children of Wilder, the subtitle The Epic Struggle to Change Foster Care. It's published by Pantheon. And questions again are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. You You explained the fact that one of the things that really drew you into the story was when you realized that right at the outset that Shirley Wilder, when she was 14 years old, I think this was in 1974, had a son, and then he went into the same system that she had gone through. She didn't know what happened to him. He didn't know anything about her. And so you, I think, set out to, first of all, to see if you could find him. What exactly was involved in your trying to find Lamont Wilder? There we got you. Sorry, we had you turned down.
Oh, sorry. Finding Lamont, first I had to find Shirley. And it 3 years passed, actually, before she resurfaced. I kept on asking, Marcia, have you heard from Shirley? Because Shirley had disappeared. And when I met her, she actually asked me to help her find her son. Once I had her permission, it was not so difficult with Marcia's help, Marcia Lowry, the lawyer's help, to locate Lamont. He was, at that point, aging out of the same system he had entered as a newborn. He was still 18, not quite 19, in a group home in the Bronx. But the real challenge was reconstructing what had happened to him. He had this photo album jumbled together. He could point, for instance, to a picture and say, those were the Millers in Minnesota. But how he had ended up in Minnesota and who exactly the Millers were, that was really the challenge. And especially during part of my effort to reconstruct this, in the earlier part, it was sort of before the search engines and the web, and I found myself prevailing upon, say, the clerk in the motor vehicles department in Minnesota to comb the Millers for the name of the son that Lamont remembered, which was an unusual name, and that way I was able to pinpoint the right Millers. I interviewed just about everybody of importance in Lamont's life, and what I discovered, and this was borne out later when an official inside the Child Welfare Administration carried me Lamont's whole confidential file in two shopping bags in the dead of night, you know, so I was able to have all the records as well. What I discovered was that Lamont, who had been placed originally with a loving Hispanic foster mother in the Bronx, was, with the best of intentions, abruptly moved when he was just turned five. Shirley's parental rights were terminated, and he was sent for adoption to a white family in Minnesota, the Millers. And after a year, they changed their minds. They passed him on to another white couple in the Minneapolis area. And as his behavior, his grief, his confusion erupted in bad behavior that seemed to this family scary in light of the rumors that they'd heard about where he had been in New York before, they sent him back to New York City, labeled unadoptable. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. It's just it's a stunning story right from the very beginning that things should have such a promising start, in a sense, that he was apparently happy with this Hispanic family and they with him. They had some troubles because the man and the woman broke up. But then for him to be taken so far away and to be adopted by a white family, and I guess I would have thought that at the time the idea of interracial adoption would have been fairly controversial, and so for that to not only to for him to be adopted by a white family, but he growing up in and living in New York to go all the way to Minnesota,
right,
to a place where it really truly would have been very foreign, just those two decisions alone seem, it just leaves one scratching one's head.
Well, I think the thing is, hindsight is 20/20, and I know that the people who were involved in this decision, like so many of the people involved in this case and Shirley and Lamont's life were well-meaning. I mean, they were not villains. But I think this echoes, in a way, this desire that we have to rescue poor children from from poverty, from what we think of as bad neighborhoods and trouble, and have them adopted by people who are better off, who can offer, you know, the two-parent family with the yard. And Minnesota to New Yorkers sounded just so wholesome, I'm sure, that a lot of this really wasn't thought through. And I feel we're really on the verge of doing very much the same thing. I mean, we're now the Adoption and Safe Families Act pushes for quicker parental termination, for quicker adoption. And ideally, adoption is humane and wonderful, but there is this law of supply and demand, which often works to the detriment of children like Lamont. And what happened to Lamont, in fact, was that he suffered tremendous emotional damage by being rejected by these white families. It certainly caused him problems in terms of his sense of himself as a black child. And then he, when he came back to New York, he essentially passed the balance of his childhood in what I would call a modern-day orphanage. It was a residential treatment center in Rhinebeck, New York, a very white, prosperous community.
Were you there when Shirley and Lamont met again?
Yes, and that was it was an extraordinary, extraordinary experience. Lamont just had grown up yearning to know who his mother was. He had these fantasies that she was an heiress who had been saving a birthday present for him each year that they were apart. And I really think this kind of fantasy is very common among foster children who don't know their parents. And Shirley had felt bad about the fact that she had this child out there. You know, on his birthday, on Mother's Day, she thought about him. And both of them were terrified that the other would be dissatisfied, would find them wanting. And when this meeting actually took place, they embraced in the middle of this major road in the Bronx. I was a reporter for Newsday at the time, and there was a photographer from Newsday with me, and we actually recorded it. It was a very an uncanny experience for me. But it was also very bittersweet because I had just before the meeting come to realize, and Lamont realized soon afterwards, that Shirley, who had a very difficult childhood and adolescence, had become a crack addict as an adult. She was 33 at that point. And for Lamont, it became this very painful, but he told me, necessary experience. He had to find his parents, he felt, before moving on in his own life. And he would literally be looking for her on the street, looking for this face of a woman who looked like him, selling herself because he realized that she had been reduced to prostitution.
And she lived only another 7 years?
That's right. She died alone in 1999 in an AIDS hospice. Marsha Lowry was one of the last people who visited her, and I know was really quite moved and devastated by her death. And in the kind of coincidence that if it were fiction, I would not have been able to make it up, it was actually the week that Shirley died that the Wilder case finally was laid to rest, because Marsha folded it into a settlement in an even larger case, an even more ambitious lawsuit against the foster care system of New York, one that tried on the basis of federal legislation requiring certain minimum standards for foster kids, requiring the system be overhauled. And I hope that it will change, but I have to say that in many ways the system in New York, despite obvious changes, is still not a very good one for the children and the families who enter it. Hmm.
Are there were there national implications of this case?
Absolutely, because this was the first, as you said at the outset, of many class action lawsuits filed against foster care systems in the country. It was part of a new wave of efforts to reform child welfare systems through the federal courts. And many of them were filed by Marsha Lowry herself, who has become a national advocate for children, the director of a Children's Rights Inc. And what she has a case, for example, pending in Milwaukee County. There are cases pending in, among other places, Tennessee. And I know you have your own case in Illinois. Hmm. Not hers, but certainly that has. Litigation has become one of the ways that people try to tackle these very intractable systems. My question, part of my question in the book was, why are they so intractable? Why have there been reform movements through American history to try to do better by the children who need substitute care, not care by their parents? And why are these systems so miserable?
And do you have an answer to that question?
Well, I have a partial answer. I think this we haven't really been willing to face the contradictions between our desire to deter poor parents from dependency and our pledges to help all needy children. And I think that actually this system of substitute care, which really is largely for the children of the poor, we haven't been willing to acknowledge that it is functioning in part as a piece of that system of deterrence. By that I mean that one of the things I stumbled on when I was researching this in terms of the history is that there were reformers in the 19th century who said, we don't want the children of the drunkard to have a better situation than the children of the working man. So, in other words, there's this kind of iron law that conditions, just as people don't want welfare to be better than, public assistance to be more generous than what the minimum wage can buy. But by the same token, I think, though they don't want to acknowledge it, they don't really want substitute care for children to be better than what the poorest working person can buy for their kids or is entitled to in terms of universal public services. The problem with that is that the consequences for children become terribly, terribly harsh, harsher than we can accept, especially in an era of growing inequality and of a kind of lowering standard at the bottom for those who are working. And I think that then we have a growth in popularity of schemes that say, well, we'll rescue these kids. We'll take them out of the ghetto and we'll put them in wonderful orphanages, like the ones Charles Murray and Newt Gingrich were proposing, or we'll have them all adopted, like Elizabeth Barthollet is saying. And I just think my story, the story that I tell in this book, which is largely the human story of Shirley and of Lamont, belies these solutions as panaceas, because you see how they really work for children in real life and how much they cost.
We have about 6 or 7 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I'd like to have you do is round out the story a little bit, and we did talk about the fact that Shirley Wilder died, and she was only 40 in 1999. Lamont, however, is still around and is the father of a child. And how is he doing?
Well, Lamont is really struggling. He's been living hand-to-mouth as a barber, a freelance barber. Ironically, reformers' efforts to make parents more self-sufficient through welfare reform, at least in New York City, have been very counterproductive in his efforts to be a real father to his little boy. He has this child support debt that was a lot of which was incurred when he was still himself in the custody of the state. He was in a group home and until he was 21, and his child was born out of wedlock when he and on welfare. And Lamont, because of his child support debt, because of the crackdown on so-called deadbeat dads, can't get a legitimate barber's license that would allow him to work in a better hair salon. He can't get a student loan. He wanted to go back to college to try to better himself. He was at one point actually jailed overnight, taken from his barber shop where he was working in handcuffs because the mother of his little boy, pursuing what all women who apply for public assistance must pursue, a court action for child support, had, in effect, sent him to jail. And indeed, the little boy the next day in school was so upset, crying, my mommy put my daddy in jail and causing such a disruption, that the school officials wanted to call Child Protective Services to investigate whether he should be taken into foster care. You know, this was just so devastating for me, frankly, when I heard about this, because the last thing you really want to see is for this third generation to go into a system which has proven itself so counterproductive for his father and for his grandmother. The one positive note I would say is that since I had a story in the Times magazine, kind of an update and adaptation from the book, this was a week ago Sunday, about Lamont's struggle to take care of his little boy. He actually filed for custody at one point. I've had quite an outpouring of people who'd like to try to help Lamont, and that's great on a personal, individual level. But I think what we really need to do, and this was, in a sense, the larger goal of my book, was to ask, what do we need to do as a society, not just as a foster care system, but more generally for a child like the child that Lamont calls Shimi, that's his nickname, who's just turned 6. What do we need to do to see that he is gets the childhood he needs to be a good father himself one day?
Well, again, that seems to bring us back to the very basic and very big question. Do we really think that we can continue to meet pressing social needs with a sort of mixture of awkward, badly structured, underfunded public agencies coupled with maybe awkward, underfunded private agencies, this sort of system that's been cobbled together over time, partly in an intentional way and partly that's just the way that it happened to work out?
It is indeed the question. And I think that though there are some wonderful agencies and programs out there, the people, the agencies and programs that are on the front lines, for the most part, what I hear from the people that I talk to in my reporting is that they cannot do this either alone or in this cobbled together way. They're really, I guess, a lot of the question is whether there is a way to put together universal services for families in a way that we can be comfortable with. I mean, I think that there are certainly some of the ideas of welfare reform were to structure assistance in a way, to repackage it in a way that we as a society could be happier with. You know, that whether it was in childcare or back to school grants or what have you. But I just think we probably are going to have to look hard at services that are inclusive rather than ones that are targeted in effect to the poorest, because those services like the foster care system end up being just a mix and match that doesn't really do the job.
Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. The book, again, for people who would like to read it, titled The Lost Children of Wilder. It's published by Pantheon by our guest, Nina Bernstein. She's a reporter for The New York Times. Ms. Bernstein, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.